Hi, this is Gideon Rossi, and this is a responsible day for the first day of Rosh Chodesh Tevet, which is an odd day in the Jewish calendar, and one that led me to cheat a little bit on our selection of responses, as I'm about to tell you. Rosh Chodesh Tevet, the first day of Rosh Chodesh Tevet doesn't always exist. The months of Cheshvan and Kislev in the Jewish calendar are 2 months that can be either 29 days or 30 days, depending on the year. So there are some years where both of them are 29 days, and I think that year is called a Chaser year, and some years are called, are both of them 30 days, which means that each month of both the months of Kislev and the month of Tevet will have 2 days of Rosh Chodesh, and then that year is called a Malay year, and then there's year Kisidro, I think, which would be that the month of Cheshvan will have 29 days, and there'll be 1 day of Rosh Chodesh Kislev, and the month of Kislev will be 30 days, or the other way around. The month of Kislev will be 29 days. I forget exactly. 1 second. Yes, where Tishrei, the way it works in the Jewish calendar is, other than other Sheni, which comes in and comes out, seven times out of 19 years, the month of Tishrei is always 30 days. There's always a first day, there's always 2 days of Rosh Chodesh Cheshvan, and the month of Cheshvan, therefore, should theoretically be 29 days because it alternates. It should be that there's only 1 day of Rosh Chodesh Kislev, 2 days of Rosh Chodesh Tevet, 1 day of Rosh Chodesh Shvat, etc., all back and forth, alternating. However, when it comes to Cheshvan and Kislev, there can be either 2 days of Rosh Chodesh or 1 day of Rosh Chodesh. So when it comes to that question for Rosh Chodesh Tevet, so there's not always a first day of Rosh Chodesh Tevet, and it happened to be that it worked out that I found a responsive for just Rosh Chodesh Tevet. It's not labeled first day or second day, and that's what we're going to do this one, because for the tomorrow's tshuva, I found the one that is labeled second day of Rosh Chodesh Tevet, which would really be the second day of Rosh Chodesh Tevet, is Aleph Tevet, is the first day of Tevet. So for today, with thanks to the OU, to Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz, and to David Hochhauser. In case you thought I was going to forget to thank people, I'm working hard on my remembering to be gracious and grateful to people, helping thanking them for putting this year online for and making them available. We're going to see Shut Ein Yitzchak Chelek Aleph, the first volume, the Orachaim section, Simon Aleph. So it's early on in this section of the book. It's from Rosh Chodesh Tevet of Tuf Reish Lamed Tet of 1878. And the case at hand was a Sefer Torah that a young man who was about 19 years old had read from, had decided had flaws and had a lot of stuff missing. He said, "Oh, there's so many problems with the Sefer Torah." He had gone to a store, like not a sofer store, not a store for special things for Torah scroll needs. He had gotten some ink, and he had replaced or fixed up like 2.5 Sfarim of Chumash. So basically like half of the Sefer Torah he says he had fixed up, he replaced himself. And he's not a well-known sofer, he's not a well-known scribe. Not only is he not a well-known scribe, nobody had ever fully checked him that he had matured as a male. So it's unclear exactly what that means, but nobody had checked him that he had the secondary sex characteristics, which usually involves bodily hair, that he had those to guarantee that he had reached full adulthood. It's something that we gloss over in regular life, is that reaching the age of 13 in halacha, in fact, is not what makes a person a man. So we make these big bar mitzvah celebrations on the 13th birthday, and by and large, most of those boys, even though they're still very, very young in a lot of physical maturity ways, have enough physical maturity that they would halakhically qualify as an adult, which would be 2 pubic hairs, basically. So nobody checked this boy. Now, if they never checked him, it means he didn't really have a beard yet. It means that you couldn't tell straight up that he definitely had developed in those ways. So nobody's checked that. So that creates a situation where we don't know if he's a qualified adult, and therefore we don't know if he can be a sofer, if he can be somebody to write a sefer Torah, and therefore maybe everything he did to the Torah is a problem rather than a help. That's one issue. And then the second issue was that the ink that he bought from the market had some of the ingredients of classic halachic ink for sefer Torah, but it was missing at least one important ingredient. So the question is the sefer Torah now usable or not usable? Now I want to say straight up at the beginning that this is one of those tshuvot, and there are many such tshuvot, where the specific halachic topic involved doesn't so much move me in the sense that, well, the Sefer Torah is either kosher or it's not kosher, and whatever it is, yes, no, when you come to a conclusion. But that the underlying principles that are invoked here are broad ones that apply in many situations, and knowing them and sort of watching a posek, watching Rav Yitzchak Elkanan Spector, not play around is the wrong word for it, but work with various halachic principles and come from there to halachic conclusions, to me that's what's more interesting here, because it reminds us of various halachic principles that are supposed to guide many situations in our lives that we don't always remember to think about. So he starts with the No Debi Yehuda. No Debi Yehuda, in a completely different context, though, had said, had applied and accepted the Chazaka de Rav. The Chazaka de Rav comes from the Gemara Nidam Emchen Amidbet, which says that we can rely and assume that when people reach adulthood, reach a certain age, that they have, in fact, developed the physical simanim, the physical demonstrate the physical markers of adulthood. We can do that b'diavad if it's already a situation. Meaning, say the point is that you'd say, "Well, check the guy now." You check him now, and he has the required evidence of physical maturity. Doesn't yet show us that he had it back then. So the first step is the reader says that b'diavad, if there's already been a situation where we can't go back and change it, and we need to know what was true back then, we can rely on this chazaka de Rava, on the assumption that Rava makes that as children mature, they develop the proper and appropriate secondary physical characteristics that denote physical adulthood in halacha. But Rabbi Akiva Eiger had a response to him where he disagreed, and he said, "No, we don't rely on that." So Rabbi Yitzchak Gaon Aspect says, but even according to Rabbi Akiva Eiger, you don't have to be machmir in our situation because it's only this young man's testimony or words or evidence that tells that the Sefer Torah had a problem at all. So that creates what Rabbi Yitzchak Gaon Aspect points out. It's what's called a sveika lehetera. Now, a sveik sveika in halacha, and there are many discussions about this, and I'm not doing it any justice, but a sveik sveika is what's called a double doubt. So we today often would like to think in percentages. I tell you something's doubtful. Let's say I say there's a 40% chance that X will happen. So that's somewhat doubtful. If I tell you there's a 5% chance, I say, "Oh, that's like almost unthinkable that it would happen. It's so unlikely." So we think that it's purely a matter of percentages. And halacha, that wasn't the way the conversation went, probably because they didn't think that they could calculate percentages with any kind of exactness, and I'm not sure that we today do calculate percentages with any kind of exactness. So in halacha, the standard of almost unthinkable, so unlikely to almost think of, is what's called a sveik sveika. So sveik sveika is where there are two separate doubts. And I have to say that percentage-wise, it doesn't have to be all that much different, meaning you can have a sveik sveika where it leaves you with a 30% doubt, but it's not the percentages that seem to matter for halacha. It's that there's two different doubts that you would have to resolve before the decision would be true. Now, very often, there's sveik sveika. So a sveik sveika lehetera is, you have two doubts about whether there's a problem here. So one problem is, you have a doubt about whether his situation was one where he wasn't qualified to do whatever he did. You have one kind of a doubt. And you have another doubt that maybe the things that he said were errors or flaws in the Sefer Torah. He didn't say flaws, he said erasures. He said things that had been rubbed out. So he says maybe those rubbed out, they were somewhat rubbed out, we trust about that, but maybe they weren't rubbed out enough to constitute a psul, to constitute something that invalidated the Sefer Torah. So that's fake sveika, combines with the fact that the Torah originally had what's called a cheskas kashrus. Cheskas kashrus means we know it was established at one point that this was a valid Sefer Torah. So in halacha, and this is one of those broad concepts, so sveik sveika is one important broad concept. You have double doubts that can create heter, even though each doubt isn't strong enough to do it on its own. And then the other broadcast that we're seeing right now is a cheskat kashrut, that at one point we know it was acceptable and valid and kosher. So when at one point we know something was valid and acceptable and kosher, so that creates a presumption that that's true until we have evidence that it's not. And it means that the bar, the evidence required to take away that presumption, that status of being kosher, is higher than just for an ordinary item. If I'm looking at an ordinary item, I don't know if it's kosher or not, I have no idea of it, right? I look at something that looks like a Sefer Torah. It seems to have parchment. It seems to have writing. I have no idea whether it's kosher or not. So the standards for establishing its kashrut, its acceptability as a Sefer Torah, are higher than for a Sefer Torah that was once upon a time for sure a Sefer Torah. So now if you tell me there are flaws in it, so then I start. So that with the Sfeik Seika should help us out to think that maybe the Sefer Torah should be okay. Besides that Sfeik Sveika, so I'm sorry, I think the first suffix, I think I might have misrepresented it. I think he might have meant just that maybe there weren't any erasures there at all. But that would be odd because it's not a Sfeik Sveika. Let's leave that for now because I don't want to get bogged down in it and I don't think it's so clear and whatever. But he says, besides that, and this is the issue that I was referred to before, he says there seems to be a very simple way of saying that the Sefer Torah should be okay, which is that there's two possibilities about this young man. Either he's not an adult, he doesn't have the physical characteristics of being an adult. If he's not an adult, then we don't have to rely on his words at all. Meaning the Sefer Torah that we look at now, we're going to see later, we haven't checked it yet, but we could just check it. And if it checks out to be okay, then it should be fine. And the fact that he says, well, now here's the thing. Let's say he says, well, it wasn't fine and I fixed it. So if he was a katan, a minor, and he fixed it, then that's not good. But if he was a minor, we don't have to believe him. Because the halacha is that even though when it comes to matters of isurim, matters of rich, of permissibility and stuff. So, for example, let's say a man comes back to his house at the end of the day. His wife serves him meat. How does he know it's kosher meat? She tells him it's kosher meat. Oh, you'll tell me women can't be witnesses in halacha. So the answer is it has nothing to do with that. Because in halacha we say eid echad ne'eman bi isurim. It doesn't take like a formal testimony process for Jews to trust each other that something is or isn't allowed. So that. The idea is it means that all Jewish adults are believed about these things, unless we have some reason not to believe them. It has nothing to do with, you know, with other characteristics that would be true of a witness in court. But a katan, a minor, it's not the same situation. We don't necessarily believe minors about Isurim situations. So if the minor is going to tell us, I'm sorry, so if this young man has not yet achieved physical maturity, then he's a minor, then we don't have to believe him there was a problem with the Sefer Torah. But if he has reached physical maturity, then we believe him about the Sefer Torah, but then he's also able to write in the Sefer Torah in a way that should be able to fix it up. So that's not a problem at all. The real problem would be that maybe we have to worry that it's now that he's reached physical maturity, so now we'll believe him, that there were, and children, adults, are often believable about what they witnessed as children, because now that they're adults, they can say, yes, this is what I saw as a child, and that's acceptable. So you have to worry that he saw flaws in the Sefer Torah. He saw things that have been rubbed out enough that it creates enough blank spaces in the Torah that it invalidates it. But before, when he fixed it up, he wasn't. So the answer that the Rav Yitzchak Gadol Inspector gives is that the halacha in Choshen Mishpat is, this is in chapter 35, that if you spend some time between two events to check a kid about whether or not he's an adult, and then you find out that he is an adult, that chazaka we are allowing halacha, just by virtue of the fact of our general assumptions about how biological development takes place, if you check, so let's say there's an event that occurs when the kid is 14, and we don't know, we didn't check the kid at 14, and by the time it winds its way through the courts, or through this, or through that, they come to us at 17, when the kid's 17, to talk about the situation. Now we check him out. So the problem is you'll say, well, now at 17 he's an adult, but how do I know at 14 he was an adult? So the halacha in Choshen Mishpat that the Rishon Inspector reports is that if we now check a kid, and he turns out, to now be an adult, we assume that goes back to the moment of his bar mitzvah. And that's why bar mitzvah is an important thing, because it does create halachic presumptions of various sorts that the kid is now a physical adult as well as having reached the age of adulthood. And we'll believe that even to trust his testimony, lo tzi mamon, to cause other people to have to pay money to other people. And Rabbi Akiva Eger thinks we take that principle so far that even those who aren't sure about it over there, the Ramban is whose name, that let's say a young man wrote tefillin at the age of 14. Nobody had checked him as to whether or not he was an adult. We check him now at 17. Turns out to be an adult. We again would validate those tefillin that he wrote, because once we see a now adult, we assume that that goes all the way back to when they were 13 years old. And anything happened in between, we assume were the actions of an adult. So he's a lot of success. So just check him now. As long as you check him now, he turns out to be an adult, and nobody's checked him until now to prove that he wasn't an adult, we can let him be thought of as, we can logically validly assume he was an adult going all the way back to 13. Now, if even now he's not a physical adult, then whatever he said about the Sefer Torah, we don't have to care about, because he's never given us adult testimony about it, and therefore we don't have to worry about it at all. So either way, this young man's role should be okay, because either he is an adult, and if he's an adult now, and we have no evidence he wasn't an adult, we can go all the way back to 13, assuming he was an adult, and that means that yes, we have to believe him the Sefer Torah was missing things, but also we can believe him, his filling it in is an act of an adult, and therefore it's fine. Or he's not an adult now, in which case we can ignore the whole thing. So there's a little bit odd to say, though, that we wouldn't believe him if he was a kid, because we have halachic sources that say we believe children about things. There's a Mishnah in Tamid that says that there are three places in the Beit HaMikdash where the Kohanim, so remember that when we had a Beit HaMikdash, and God willing, one day soon we will have a Beit HaMikdash again, you would have at night and during the day, but even more prominently at night, people watching at various places. Now, it wasn't so much like guarding it to make sure nobody broke in, although there was that element of it. It was more like an honor guard, that anything that's worth guarding should have guards. So most of it was done by the Levim, but there were three places that the Mishnah tells us where it was Kohanim who would guard it, who would watch it. And the Bar Tanura there says, those Kohanim, they would do it, they would give it to kids, meaning you were an 11, 12-year-old kid who was one day going to be an adult Kohen, they would give you this job, sort of like an honor job, and you would do it. But the problem is that we require those Kohanim to the guard, they infer it there from Pesukim. They show Pesukim that show us this obligation to have an honor guard of Kohanim and Levim around the Beit HaMikdash. If that's true, then it's an obligation from the Torah. And we don't usually rely on minors to fill an obligation for the Torah, mostly because they can't tell us they did their job well because they don't have a halachic status of ne'emanut, of being believed, because as we said, it's only once you get to be an adult that you're believed about things. So at a Torah level, we don't rely on them to say, yes, we didn't sleep, and yes, we watched. So Rav Yitzchak Inspector says, no, I haven't answered that. There's a shach in Yoredeya in a different context, but the shach in Yoredeya, this is in a kashrus context, but the shach in Yoredeya says that where the minor had the easy ability to do something, either to help something be good or help something be bad, whatever it is, but it was easily possible for the minor to affect the situation, then we believe him, even though tzidavar mechazkato, even to change a presumptive halachic status. I mean, let's say something is assumed to be kosher, and the minor comes along and says, you know, it's not kosher anymore. So if it's the kind of thing where the minor himself or herself, I think, could have done it, could have affected the situation, then we believe them even on a Torah level thing. And so too, there's a Rish Rush that sounds like that, and Iran, and so whatever it is, it sounds like that's true. And that's why, by the way, we, says the Shach, we rely on Kitanim, on minors, to watch things that are permissible, and we don't say, well, how do we know that it's still that thing? How do we know something didn't happen to it? So you say, well, the minor told me nothing happened. But we're not allowed to generally believe minors. And the answer is, if it's something that's in the minor's power to control, so by and large, watching things that they don't get unkosher, they don't get ruined, is the kind of thing that a minor can take care of, and then we're allowed to believe them. So if that's true, then there's lots of situations where we could believe minors, but it wouldn't be true about our Sefer Torah. Why not? Because the minor can't fix the Sefer Torah. Why can't he fix the Sefer Torah? Because the minor isn't a scribe, can't serve as a scribe to fix the Sefer Torah. So therefore, if it's a not biyado, if it's not something that he has the power, that's another important concept that comes up in other areas as well, the idea of biyado, that the believability of a person, in this case it's a minor, but applies to other things in halakha as well, the believability is of a person depends, at least somewhat, on that person's ability to control the situation. So it's obvious that if he can't control it, then we don't believe him. So again, that's not fully obvious, because there is Allah in Yerudea Memchet Yudbet, that we will sometimes believe a katan if he's really chari, if he's really bright. So even though he's still a minor, we'll believe him. So the Rav Yitzchak Inspector says that's really only though if there's what's called raglayan ladavar. Raglayan ladavar means we have some evidence, not halachically valid evidence to clinch a situation. We have some evidence that the situation is a certain way, and a katan who is wise beyond his years, as it were, tells us that would happen, then we're allowed to believe him as well. And he also says that will only create a suffix. It doesn't clinch the argument. It doesn't tell us fully what happened, but it's enough that we will pay attention to it and worry about it. So all of that, though, wouldn't seem to be relevant here, because we're talking about him writing. He doesn't have a biyada. We're talking about him having to write a Sefer Torah, although he would have obviously counted as a Karif, I think. But it would seem like if he's still a Katan, we wouldn't have to believe him. Then Rav Yitzchak Inspector says, and this all, however, is talking about whether or not we can read a Sefer Torah, right, and use it for a valid kiyum ha-mitzvah, a valid fulfillment of the obligation to read a Sefer Torah. So you might say to yourself that the levels of standards of proof aren't quite as high as usual, because the general obligation to read the Sefer Torah in public is a derabbanan. It's generally a rabbinic practice that we read the Torah in public. The only example that Rav Yitzchak Inspector refers to as being a biblical obligation to read the Torah in public is, many of us know this, but it's Parsha Zachar, right? The obligation, and I have to say, not that he brings it up at all, but if you'll allow me to interpret that, I'll just point out that that itself is an interesting question as to whether, in fact, Zachar has to be read from a Sefer Torah, but let's follow his reasoning right now. Zachar is a Torah requirement, as Tosos say, and the Magen Avraham says it. So if it's a Torah requirement for Zachar, that's the only time it's d'oraita, but when it's d'rabbanan, we often say sveika d'rabbanan l'kula, that we can just go leniently in a doubt. So if we have a doubt about this Sefer Torah is valid, we have reasons on both sides, maybe we can just be mekel. So a counter-argument that would be another, you know, alert, there's another principle coming along. When we say sveikos are l'kula or l'chumra, it becomes a different story when a suffix is what's called yesh biyado levirure bikal. This is a suffix that we can easily look into quickly how, by we could just check the Sefer Torah. We can see if there's any erasures, because he only said he fixed 2.5 Svarim. We could check there, we could check other parts of the Sefer, and therefore you could say that you shouldn't read it, because it's the kind of thing you can check. You shouldn't read it even in Durabanan readings. But nonetheless, he says it's really only a Suffolk at a Durabanan level. It's only rabbinic issues that led us to have this doubt at all. Since it's a doubt at a rabbinic level, you can put it together with all of the other doubts that we've had, and therefore you can say that you're allowed to assume that it's okay. So now that it's been fixed, and they've checked into it, fixed it, we have two doubts in front of us. One is whether or not it was ever puzzle, and since we don't know that for sure, that would lead us to say maybe we can think it's okay. And two, that maybe he was an adult when he fixed whatever was puzzle. So if he was an adult, then there was a psul. These are two separate doubts. One, was there ever any psul? And two, if there was a psul when it got fixed, was he an adult when he fixed it? In which case, it's okay that he fixed it. Now, it's true we only heard of these two doubts together, and they sort of, in some sense, are linked to each other. But since it's Rabbanan, he thinks you're allowed to make one that way. And therefore, he thinks you could read it even for d'oraita reading, because you have a double doubt and a rabbinic doubt. So even though we're going to now apply it to a Torah principle, to a Torah situation, to a d'oraita situation, he thinks it's okay. And I would just point out that here, at this point in the tshuva, he mentioned not only Zohar, but Para as well. He doesn't get into it, so I won't go into it in any length, but it's a reminder that there are those who claim, it's a much smaller group, who claim that even Parshat Para is a d'oraita reading. Earlier in the Tshuva, he only referred to Zachar. Here he refers to Para. I have to say, I think it's like what's called a Pleitata Hakulmus. I think it's like he's got you, Zachar and Para are often mentioned together. He got used to writing. I don't think he was taking the position that Para is d'oraita. I think he really meant to say that Zohar is d'oraita. But the point is, he thinks at this point when the Sefer Torah in front of us has been fixed, and it looks fixed, so all the doubts that we have should be okay. We could even read it d'oraita on d'oraita readings. But what about the ink? So that would be true in terms of the way the Sefer Torah looks. But we started off by pointing out that the kid took ink from, just bought regular, basically regular ink, which is missing some of the important ingredients. So in Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yitzchak Inspector points out, Shulchan Aruch doesn't mention that ingredient as being indispensable. There is an opinion of the Rush that says that no, that ingredient is missing, which was guma, which is a rubberish kind of thing, I think. But that ingredient that you'd mix into the ink, liquid rubber, anyway, but that ingredient doesn't, that the Rush held, that if that ingredient isn't there, that it's invalid, but the Shulchan Aruch didn't quote it. It's true that Magen Avraham said it's better to be machmir, to be stringent, and to include it in the ink, but b'dieved, then you can rely on the Shulchan Aruch. You don't have to worry about a Magen Avraham. If, nonetheless, the people want to worry about it, they want to be careful about it, what they can do is, they can write over it again in good ink. Now, writing over a Sefer Torah again isn't so simple in halacha. There are those who hold the Rambam holds, the dio al gabe dio. If you write with ink on ink, it doesn't count as writing, and therefore it will invalidate the Sefer Torah. But the Rambam happens to have held that the ink that the kid bought from the marketplace is a fine ink. So if you're going to put, you know, if you're going to go wherever the kid wrote, and you're going to write over it again, for the Rambam it'll be okay, because he thinks the original thing was okay, and the new ink doesn't count at all, because it doesn't count as kitab. So he thinks you're okay. Others, the Rak and the Rashba, who thought maybe that the ink that the kid bought would be a problem, they would think, though, that the second writing is valid, because they think that dio al gabe dio, that when you have ink on top of ink, that in fact the second ink does count as a writing, and therefore that would validate that. Now, you might think that, well, but what if I missed some? What if the kid doesn't remember all the places that he fixed up? So I'm going to go back, and I'm going to fix up the place that he tells me he fixed up, but I'm not going to know all of the places, and therefore I'm going to miss them, and therefore I'd have an issue. So he said, and that's because says that every letter in this Sefer Torah also had a chazaka de meikara, and it has a chazaka now. We see it now, it looks good, and originally it was good, so if the kid doesn't actually point out to us, say, that's one that I fixed, that's one I fixed, we don't have to worry about it. And that's leads to another important principle that he brings up here, which is called principle of kanimtsa kan haya. That in many, many situations in halacha, you can just assume that when you find something and where you find something is where it's always been. That's sort of like just a general chazaka principle. It's like another example of the general idea that we think that things continue the way they are. But here it comes up in other situations where it's not only that you think where they are, they think that the placement of where they are. So for example, the Ramban wrote, let's say you find a get and it says, that was written in a certain place. You find it in a certain place, and it says the name Yehuda Bar Shimon. And then we find out that in, you know, another place, there's another Yehuda Bar Shimon. So you might say to yourself, well, I have to worry. Maybe that Yehuda Bar Shimon had to get written for him, and then it's a completely different get than this guy is going to use, and this and this and this. So we say no, kanimtsa kadhaya. Since we found the get here, we assume that it's always been here, and if it's always been here, it'll have been written for the Yosef Yehuda B'Shimon or whatever the name was in this town. You don't have to worry about some other towns. When there are two Yehuda B'Shimons in a town, then you have more of a problem. But here we're talking about you have a Yehuda B'Shimon, let's say, you know, in Teaneck, and then you hear that in Los Angeles, California, there's another Yehuda B'Shimon. So I find a get in Teaneck, you say, hey, yeah, I don't have to. That's kanimtsa kadhaya. The fact that I found it here is enough evidence that it was written here for people here that I don't have to worry about some far-off situation. In our case as well, each letter had an original chazaka. It was established originally when the Sefer Torah was for sure good as being good. Then we say kanimtsa kadhaya. You look at it, you'll say, maybe the kid fixed it up and the kid doesn't remember that he fixed it up. Nope. We have the right to say that it's always been here in this way unless we have other reasons to believe that it has been changed. Now, a possibility that you might have worried about, let's say some of the places where you're going to write over again, that was his advice. His advice was to write over again and then you'll for sure fix up any problems you have, write over wherever the kid points. Yeah, what if the kid points out a Shem Hashem? So a Shem Hashem, a name of Hashem, is something that's not to be erased. And writing over it in some halachic sources sounds like it might be a form of erasure. Now, the Rambam thought it was nothing, so that would certainly be okay. But if it's a form of erasure, you have a problem, because in Gittin, Daf Yutet, it tells you that writing over certain things is an erasure, but Rav Yisrael Spector points out, but that's two different kinds of ink there. That's when you're going to use Dio ink, Algabe Sikra, which is a different kind of ink, or I think a reddish kind of ink. So there, and it says on Shabbos, you'd be liable for erasing as well as for writing. So if we're going to erase, you're not allowed to erase Shem Hashem, so maybe that's not going to be a solution we can work out. So Rav Yisrael Spector says, no, because Dio, W-D-O, is not going to be an erasure at all. It's only a writing. And Rashi explains, because it's the exact same thing. You're not changing anything. And therefore, it should be okay. So his conclusion is, of the Psak, is that those letters that the young man remembers that he fixed, we should write over again with a kumus, with the right ink, with the exact ink. And ideally, you should do it before you reach Parsha Zachar, and therefore you can use it even for Parsha Zachar. And Parah again, he writes, because then it'll be all right to evaluate Sefer Torah again. They should check the Sefer Torah very carefully and fix up whatever is the problem. Then we don't have any worries. He then adds like a postscript about the possibility, and I think what happened was that the Rav who was writing to him wanted to know about the idea of, there's this idea, let's say you find three problems in something. When we find three problems, then establish a chazaka. So the Rav Yisrael Chaim Spector has been talking about this Sefer Torah as if it has a cheskas kashrut. It has a presumption of being a valid Sefer Torah, which is fine, except that in other cases of halacha, when you have a presumption of something, and then you have three counterexamples, we say, oh, that presumption now goes away. So why would we say this? Since we found way more than 3 errors in the Sefer Torah, maybe its whole cheskas kashrus goes away. So Yisrael says, in fact, he thinks that that's a misstatement of the idea. He thinks when we say there are three problems, you have to assume there are problems. That's only when you didn't have a well-established presumption of heter, a well-established presumption about something about a particular body or a particular, you know, object. You know, if you have well-established chazaka presumptions, then he thinks you do have that. So he says, for example, we think of vestot as derabanan. Vestot, let's remember, are when a woman has her menstrual cycle, so women are more regular than other women. Some women are very regular. When they're very regular, that establishes in halacha a presumption that she can assume and know when she's going to menstruate. Now, that presumption sometimes is the kula, and sometimes the chumra. It's the kula that she doesn't usually have to worry about menstruating other times if she has a well-established veset, but it's a chumra that on the day of the veset, on the time of the veset, or the event of the veset, whatever it is that gives her regular presumption that she's going to menstruate, she has to assume she is. Now, that's a derabanan principle. We assume in halacha, or Yisrael Chaim Spector is assuming, and that's true even though she's had it three times. Why wouldn't you say, well, if it establishes three times, it establishes a full presumption, even at Torah level. And why wouldn't you say, that when her veset comes, when that time or whatever it is that establishes the regularity appears, that we would assume she definitely saw. We don't. We say we have a suffix that she saw. We have a doubt. We have to think that maybe she saw. And then under Rabbanan, you have more stringencies about that situation on that day or at that time. And since it's only a doubt, Rav Yisrael Chaim Spector points out, if we also have a possibility that she went to a mikvah afterwards, we will allow ourselves to group those together into a sveika, into a double doubt, and that will allow us to rule lenially. So why is that? If you're telling me that three events establish a set of facts that we have to assume have occurred, So why wouldn't that be true? So it has to be that since she herself has cheskas tahara, women in general, wives in general, are permitted to live with their husbands. It's true that we know that regular, some kind of regularity, monthly, every 2 months, or whatever it is, she's going to have a period, a time, when she's not going to be able to live with her husband. She's going to not be permitted, but she has a general cheskas tahara. After she goes to mikvah, so she has general cheskas tahara and a general cheskat heter lebaal, a general that she assumption that she's permitted to her husband. So that's why the vesra d'rabbanan. That exactly proves this point. Where we have something that's well established one way, three examples the other way don't uproot the whole thing. They just create a reality that we have to deal with, that we have to worry about. But not that. That would be the same thing for the Sefer Torah. It has a cheskat heter, a cheskas kashrus, not heter, a chezaka that you could use as reading the Sefer in the shul. Then you found problems with it. Those problems will create a doubt about it, and we'll have to reestablish that it's okay, but they won't just completely ruin its cheskat heter, and therefore in situations where we don't have definite problems, we have possible problems, the still existing cheskas kashrus, the presumption that it's a valid, that's okay, that could be used, will help us also see those as doubts rather than as establishing facts the other way. Now, that's not true if you found errors in the Sefer Torah. Because if you find errors in the writing of the Sefer Torah, then you can say, well, maybe it never had, then apparently it never had a cheskas kashrus. It never was established as being a valid Sefer Torah. Because once I find three errors, I have to worry there are lots more errors. Maybe there are enough errors that the whole Sefer Torah is invalid. So that's not going to be the same thing. But we're not talking about that here. We've been talking about where there are erasures, where it's been worn away over time. So that says nothing about its original validity. And therefore, that original validity can still help us out as we work our way, as we have, through the issues that come up here. It's true, he says, that we find that in the drabanan of women menstruating and their vestot, that we are machmir, chazal were machmir, that we don't talk about her cheskas heter in those kinds of conversations. But he said that's only because that's an iser karet. Because if a man and his wife, a husband and wife, have marital relations while she is a nida, while she is in that situation, in that state of menstruating and has not yet gone to mikvah, that's a karet prohibition. So where it's a karet prohibition, we won't rely on as many presumptions of heter, presumption of permissibility as we other would. Now he says, but it's true that we, in some cases, in halakha say, but a prohibition is a prohibition, and we don't differentiate and say, oh no, since it's so much more serious, we have to act differently. So he says, but it could be that when you have an iser asay, that's even more light. In like our situation, the iser asay is, I think he means that we are not, that it's only that we have an obligation to read from a positive, from a valid Sefer Torah. It's not a prohibition that we're violating. It's that we need to read from a Sefer Torah that's valid. And then the last piece that we'll see, that we'll talk about, was a very brief one. It's the rabbi who was writing to Ritzkong's book, says, but you know, it's not true that Shabbat Zachor is the time at a Torah level you have to read the Sefer Torah with the Parashah of Zachor. The obligation to read the Torah once a year is the assumption of these opinions. Once a year, freed from the Torah, about Amalek, to remember what we have to do Amalek, that Hashem is commanded to do about Amalek, that's not limited to the parts of Zachar. That's just when Jewish custom became to read it. So maybe you should tell me that this Sefer Torah has issues at the Oraita level, which would change our whole calculus, as we've already discussed many throughout this responsum. So Rishon LeZion says, it's true that you could read it for Zachor anytime you want to, but once the custom became that we fulfill this once-year obligation on Parshas Zachor, then the Sefer Torah until then is only needed for rabbinic purposes, and therefore, as we check it, we can rely on the rabbinic levels of issues. So those are some, many important halachic principles of how we deal with doubts and how we deal with worries about situations, what presumptions we're allowed to use, what presumptions we're not allowed to use, what's a derabbanan doubt, what's a derabbanan doubt. Now, you're talking to an inspector, reviewed for us in the context of a question about a Sefer Torah and whether a young man who we were not yet sure was a halachic adult could fix that Sefer Torah and whether we had to trust his testimony about it. And this is all from Rosh Chodesh Tevet, and we're assuming for now, the first day of Rosh Chodesh Tevet is probably that year, is probably actually just the one day of Rosh Chodesh Tevet of Tav Reish Lamed Tet of 1878. That's a responsible day. With thanks to you, Rabbi Jacob Ramos, David Hochhauser. Have a great day.